Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. I am delighted today to welcome my friend and former Beg to Differ colleague, Linda Chavez, because we are celebrating the publication of Linda's first full-length novel, The Silver Candlesticks. Linda, congratulations on this great new book, which I finished on the plane ride home from France just the other day. So I wanted to ask you before, you know, we get into it, you have the most amazing backstory of anybody that I can think of for why you chose to write this book. So why don't we start there? What is it about you that made you say, I want to write a book about the Spanish Inquisition, which most of us these days only think of, you know,
Monty Python. Right. Who expects the Spanish Inquisition?
Right. So tell us about the whole backstory.
So I went back to get a graduate degree of MFA in creative writing at the age of 65 and had been writing short stories. I got some short stories published and was very interested. In that period, I was contacted by Henry Louis Gates' show, Finding Your Roots. Mm-hmm. And they were doing going to be doing an episode, and they were sort of focusing on three different Hispanics and their background. And so Henry Louis Gates knew who I was because I was a prominent conservative. And so he invited me to be on. So when they were interviewing me, they said, are there any mysteries in your family? And I said, well, I really know my family history. They were a prominent family, two families, Chavez and Armijo families in New Mexico. They were there, you know, for the founding. Don Pedro Durante Chavez, who was actually a captain in the expedition, the Juan de Oñate expedition that founded New Mexico. So I said, I really know most.
What year?
Okay, this was the late 1500s. They actually ended up arriving in Santa Fe around 1601, I think is when Captain Durante Chavez got there. So I said, I don't really know much. He said, well, there must be some mystery. I said, well, couple of things. One is these Chavez and Armijo families for almost 400 years kept intermarrying. It seemed like the cousins were always marrying cousins, you know. So what's that about? That's a little strange. And then I said, and then there was this odd custom that my grandmother Petra had. And it was that on Friday nights, she would turn her statue of the Niño de Atocha, which is the Christ child. It's a Spanish saint that was brought over by, you know, the Spaniards when they came here. But she'd turn it to the wall. And I would always ask her, you know, Grandma, why are you doing that? And she'd just always make up a story. I'm mad at him. He didn't answer my prayers or something. So I mentioned
it was
that.
Every Friday.
Every Friday, as I recall. So that seemed... So I said, then there is that. So, of course, when you're on Finding Your Roots, they don't tell you anything until you're actually being filmed live. But they did reveal to me in Spain, I happened to have had a previously scheduled trip to Sevilla, Spain, and they took me to the archives and they started showing me all these documents about the Armijo family. And when they came, I saw the manifest 1597. There were actually two
when they
trips
came to the New World, you mean?
To the New World, right, to the New World. And so then he shows me the historian who was working with the show shows me a book, and it's Inquisition Records. And they, you know, pointed to the name, and I said, oh my goodness, that was my like 11th or 12th great-grandmother, Benita. She was Benita Perez at this time, but her family were Orozcos.
If you're like me, you've noticed that getting older is full of little wake-up calls. You start seeing more hair in the drain, your part looks wider, and suddenly you're zooming in on old photos wondering if your hair was always this thin. That's why I'm really loving what OneSkin is doing. Their OS01 peptide has been transforming our skin here at the Mona Charon Show for a while. Now, with their new scalp serum, OS01 Hair, it's here to help us with hair loss, thinning, and shedding. Why would a skincare company create a scalp treatment? Well, because the scalp is skin. And just like the rest of your body, it experiences cellular aging. But instead of wrinkles, it messes with your hair follicles and natural growth cycle, leading to hair loss and thinning. OS1 Hair is the first scalp serum powered by OneSkin's OS01 peptide, which targets those aging cells called senescent cells, and it's scientifically proven to help your hair cells do what they're meant to do. Grow denser, fuller, healthier hair. Get to the root of hair loss and thinning with OS01 Hair. You'll save 15% on your first purchase with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. Anybody who knows me knows that I am really, I don't obsess about personal appearance, but two things I'm really into are healthy teeth and healthy hair. So this is very important to me. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you.
Linda, can I interrupt real quick?
Sure.
Just to ask you something? As somebody who cannot trace their ancestry back before my grandparents, how in the heck did you know that?
Well, I didn't. Yes. Well, okay. I knew some because they were founders. They were very prominent families in New Mexico.
Okay.
Third great uncle, Manuel Armijo, the reason we have New Mexico, California, Arizona, Nevada, parts of Colorado, and parts of Wyoming as part of the United States was that he turned it over. He was the last territorial governor of New Mexico, and he turned it over to the Americans without much of a fight, I might
add. So he was with the Mexican government.
Right.
Yeah.
He had been appointed. He was a governor twice. Mexico actually controlled New Mexico for only about 28 years. It was directly controlled by Spain. And then when Mexico broke off from Spain and declared their independence, and it became Mexican. But anyway, so this is how I know. And what I discovered, and I think it may have something to do with why you can't find your roots, is that if you own property, and it turns out they were a wealthy merchant family, there are records, there are estate sales, there are wills, the marriages are recorded. And the Spaniards are terrific record keepers. They have, wonderful archives. So anyway, so they show me this name of my 12th great grandmother, Benita, and she's being investigated by the Inquisition. So suddenly the intermarriage between these families starts to make sense. And
explain that.
In 1492, not only did Christopher Columbus sail the blue and find the new world in his travels, it was also the year that Spain kicked out all of the Jews and all of the Arab Muslims who were, the Arabs controlled Spain for 800 years. So there was a war against, this Islamic control of southern Spain. So that happened in 1492. But Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand also expelled all the Jews. Well, what I discovered and didn't know is that many of the Jews who left in 1492 left because they didn't own property. The thing was, you weren't just expelled. You could stay and convert to Catholicism. But if you, if you own property and you left, you couldn't take anything with you. So the wealthier people in the community who were Jewish decided to convert to Catholicism, preserve their lives. And so for about 100 years, they were secret Jews, usually called conversos, sometimes called Moranos. And that's what my family were. They were secretly practicing Judaism. And so when they came to the New World, I think they were seeking out other families. And New Mexico, which is, where they were, where they ended up being, is rife with families that can trace back their history to those times and who it turns out were secret Jews. And many of those same people now are sort of, you know, reclaiming those roots and becoming members of Jewish synagogues, etc.
Including a priest I once read. There was a priest.
Oh, yes. And actually, one of the Chavez, when we tried to trace not just the Armijo family, who were the subject of this novel, but the Chavez family, one of the people that we think was Jewish was not just a priest. He was a member of the Inquisition. And that was a really good protection if you were on the side, right? You know. So anyway, so I decided when that show aired, my thesis advisor, Alan Shoes at George Mason University, I had been writing all these stories about North Korean prison camps and, you know, being successful publishing them. He said, no, you got to write this story. This is such a great story.
It is.
So, you know, so that's what prompted me to write it. And also my own personal history. I, at the age of 18, met my husband. I was a student in his mother's modern dance course at the University of Colorado. He was Jewish. And so I converted to Judaism to be married in the synagogue in Denver. It turns out so did my sister marry a Jew, and so did my aunt marry a Jew. So what are the odds, you think, that, you know, these three members of one family all end up Hispanics, all end up marrying Jews? So anyway, so that was the backstory.
Was your sister also marrying someone who was Jewish, and did she
convert
for the same reason?
She did. She did. Absolutely.
How many years apart were these weddings?
Well, that's a whole subject maybe of another book. My sister and I are 7 months apart. So we had different mothers, obviously. And my father got around, apparently. And we had lost touch with each other. At the age of five, she was given up for adoption by her mother. And so we had lost touch. But when we reconnected, we discovered all of these things in common.
Amazing. And the thing about the cousins marrying each other is that I gather from having read the
Jewish families.
That was the only way they could feel secure. Right.
Right. And actually, so this story is about my grandmother, Guiomar, and Guiomar Perez, and she marries Francisco Armijo. So that was another thing that they found in searching the backgrounds. It was very odd that they married each other. Because,
why?
Well, Francisco was a candle maker. And she was the daughter of a very wealthy merchant. Well, you might think, well, maybe, you know, baby was born 8 months later or something.
Yeah.
Nothing like that happened. And so the hypothesis was the Armijo family in Sevilla at the time were old Catholics. And Spain differentiated between old Catholics and new Catholics. New Catholics meant they had converted within the previous 100 years, and they were suspect of being continuing to practice Judaism. And so by the time this novel opens in 1587, there is a new purge and burnings. The novel opens with one of the first auto de fes in the city of Sevilla. And so the best way to protect someone, if the church inquisition in the church noticed that two new Catholic families were intermarrying, aha, that's proof. They're clearly intermarrying because they're continuing to practice Judaism. But a new Catholic marrying into an old Catholic family was less suspect. So I use that as the kernel of my story. And this is a story that takes place over 10 years. The young woman, Guiomar, is very unhappy because she's in love with somebody else. And then her, you know, mother tells her, no, no, no. And she then learns that she's Jewish. And so thus the candlesticks, the silver candlesticks are a symbol that goes throughout the book. And they are the Sabbath candlesticks that were used in their Sabbath meals on Friday night.
Hi, everyone. We all have our secret weaknesses, and I must confess that one of mine is shopping online for clothing. I don't always buy, but I do like to sneak over and see what's out there. And you know what the disappointing part is? So much of the time, it's just you cannot find the basics that are so important to your wardrobe. You know, you just can't, I mean, you'll find all kinds of flowery things, but like a simple white top or black or, you know, something basic is really hard to find. And that's why I was so excited when Quince became a sponsor, because I had already found them on my own before they became a sponsor of this podcast. So not only do they have those basics that we all need, but they have them at unbelievable prices. So, and it's good quality stuff. So I don't know how they do it, but they really do deliver a good product at a very fair price. They have, for example, 100% European linen shorts and dresses from $30. They have Luxe swimwear, Italian leather platform sandals. They have leather jackets that are really nice. They have all kinds of really good things. And again, as I say, it's like the basics for your wardrobe that are good quality. How do they do this? Well, apparently by working with top artisans and cutting out the middlemen so that they can give you the luxury without the markup. Give your summer closet an upgrade with Quince. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/Mona to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Mona. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. You do have to wonder, don't you? And you must have thought about this. Like, what in the world would keep people practicing a secret religion when the price was so high? And as you document in this novel, I mean, it wasn't just that you could lose your property or be expelled. It's you could be tortured to death, or you could be imprisoned for years at a time in some dungeon. So what do you think was the appeal? What kept people being secret Jews?
That was what I struggled with throughout writing the novel, because that quick question, you know, immediately occurred to me. Wouldn't it just be easier to, you know, just be Catholic?
Yeah.
You know, and I think what I tried to describe was the burden, really, of being the chosen people, and that, you know, God established a covenant with the Jews, and that covenant had to be maintained. And so it was really as much about family and tradition and culture as it was about a theological attachment. I mean, these people at this time, I mean, there weren't Torahs around, there weren't Bibles. And of course, at the time this novel is taking place, all of the synagogues in Spain had been destroyed or converted to churches. That was one of the frequent things. They'd be converted to churches, as, by the way, were the mosques that had been the Muslims' places of worship. In fact, one of the most beautiful basilicas in the world is in Cordoba in southern Spain, and it was a mosque before becoming a church.
I don't think I've been there. I might have been there, but I know that I was in Granada and saw the Alhambra, which was this beautiful, this was when the Muslims, when the Moors controlled Spain, and they built this palace complex that is just magnificent, even today. So we happened to have been there in the summer, so it was about 110 degrees. But you go into these gardens with these beautiful blue tiles and fountains. And it's
and
so,
oranges.
And the scent oranges. Of oranges, yes.
Naranjos, yes.
Yes.
Right.
And
yes.
It is just magnificent.
Yes.
And, you know, the period of Moorish dominance in Spain was actually a golden age.
Golden age. It's referred to as the golden age. And by the way, Maimonides, the famous Jewish theologian, I think he was in Cordoba. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting for your pop culture fans, anybody who watched the Game of Thrones, one of several of the episodes take place in not the Alhambra, but the Alcazar, which also figures prominently in my book. And so all of these scenes of these gorgeous gardens and fountains and stuff were filmed in Spain. And what happened when the reconquest of southern Spain came In 1492, that was the year that there was victory by the Catholics.
Spanish. It had been a slow process over hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years, yeah. Went on for hundreds of years. But the final victory was in 1492. And, you know, what happened was they came in, they took over. As I say, they, you know, they didn't knock down the synagogues or the mosques. They basically incorporated them into mm-hmm. the religion. And southern Spain in particular, there are many cultures in Spain. There's the Basque culture, Catalan, the area of northern Spain or mid-Spain, Madrid, and that whole area. Toledo was another center of Jewish learning. But southern Spain in particular, Andalusia, is very rich with the kind of mixture of Jewish, Muslim, and Catholic. And the architecture is very specific. The beautiful tile work that we associated with Spain, that was Moorish. That was brought with the Moors. And so anyway, so, you know, I had been going to Spain before I started writing this book. I didn't actually know that the Armijos were from Sevilla.
Oh,
I only discovered that. I even, you know, in the process of discovering all of this, I can walk down the street where my ancestors live. I visited the church Santa Ana in the parish of Triana.
Which plays a big role big in the role, novel. Right.
big role in the novel. But the baptismal fount there, where my ancestors were no doubt baptized, it actually dates to 1492.
Unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, it was so thrilling to learn all this. And of course, because I was raised Catholic, and have a, you know, tremendous attachment to, you know, Catholic ritual, a Catholic church. I was able to incorporate this struggle. What do you do? I mean, you know, you've been praying to the Virgin Mary. You're, you know, used to having the statues and going to church and having the incense. And then suddenly you're told, no, you're Jewish. And you know nothing about it because there was no, you know, active Jewish life. It's all in secret. These are people who have to maintain their secret or else they could lose their lives. And the Inquisition was also, it was like a police state, except it happened to be being run by the church at the time.
Can I interrupt mm-hmm. real quick to
sure.
ask a question about that? Because it's my understanding, well, maybe you can spell this out. So the Spanish Inquisition was an operation of the Spanish crown, right? It was run.
Yes and no.
Okay.
It was the Pope, in fact, basically formalized the Spanish Inquisition. So a very important part of the book, it takes place in Triana, which is across the river, the Guadalquivir, in Sevilla that separates one part of the city from the other. And my family were in Triana, which is not the traditional Jewish neighborhood. The Barrio Santa Cruz is the traditional part of Sevilla that was Jewish. At any rate, the right at the gateway, there is a castle there, the Castillo San Jorge. And that is where the Inquisition operated out. So basically, the church is running the Inquisition. They are there to root out, not Jews, heretics. And because conversos were practicing Catholicism, but secretly also practicing Judaism and believing in Judaism, they were not being persecuted because of, you know, their race. They were being persecuted because they are heretics. And so what they're trying to do is to get people to admit that they are, you know, not really Catholic. And it was an acceptable means at the time. I mean, anybody who's seen A Man for All Seasons or stories about Thomas More and other things, torture was an acceptable method. Now, the church and the inquisitors operated the machinery of discovering who these families were, subjecting them to questioning, including questioning under torture. But interestingly, the church had very, very strict rules about this. People could only be tortured for a certain amount of time. If they confessed to being Jews under torture, they had to sign the papers later and admit. Now, of course, if you're having in your mind, gee, if I don't, you know, admit this, they're going to put me back on the rack. you know, chances are you're going to go along and admit it. But they could not execute. So this is where your question comes in. So the church did not execute people. They were remitted to the state, and the state carried out the executions. So, you know, my book opens
of that the state was also enforcing laws.
Absolutely.
Against heresy.
I mean, yeah. These were the cat, you know, it was Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. They're known as the Catholic monarchs. And
right.
So, you know, it was a state religion. So the church and the state were virtually one. But, you know, the church likes to make it very clear. And it took years and years and years for the Catholic Church to apologize for the Inquisition. The interesting thing is, Mona, growing up, I knew about the Inquisition when I was quite young, I think by fourth grade, and I was fascinated by it. I was always trying to read about, you know, and here I am in Catholic school trying to, you know, read about the Inquisition.
Was it mentioned in your Catholic school?
Yes,
Did you hear about it?
I mean, we knew about the Inquisition. But you know, I don't think other students were as fascinated. So I sort of, you know, it's almost, you know, you sort of wonder, you know, it's
like
Jungian or something that, you know, how is it that I was always interested in this?
Yeah.
My family keeps intermarrying with Jews. It's very strange. So this is the heart of the novel. What does it mean? And Guiomar, who discovers that she's Jewish, it's doubly upsetting. She wants to marry this handsome guy, Jose Marcos, whom she's in love with. She thinks she's in love with. She's like 18 or 19 years old.
What does she know?
What does she know, right? And he's dashing, but he's also, yeah, he's a jerk.
Right.
So, but she wants to marry him. And suddenly her mother says, not only you're Jewish, but you're going to marry this guy next door who's a candle maker. And it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
No, he's beneath me. How can you? And then she tries to, you know, the mother explains, it's an old Catholic family and we are protecting you. And it turns out Guiomar's older brother is actually a Dominican priest. And it was the Dominicans who ran the Inquisition. So again, he became a Dominican priest so that he could learn the Torah. Because there were no Bibles. The ordinary people didn't the Old Testament among Christians. So that's, you know, so there are a lot of ways in which there were efforts to preserve. And then there's a little book that her brother gives Guiomar that begins to explain some of the rituals, because she knows none of this.
The old adage, you are what you eat, rings very true to all of us in the modern day. And I'm always looking for an on-the-go protein snack that satisfies me. But now I found one that helps me to live intentionally, too. Mosh bars. Mosh, which you may have heard about on Shark Tank, was founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger, with a simple mission to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. Mosh joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to go beyond your average protein bar. With 8 delicious flavors, including a plant-based one in peanut butter and chocolate, each Mosh bar is made with ingredients that support brain health, like ashwagandha, lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. And now, Mosh bars come with a new look and a new formulation featuring a game-changing, brain-boosting ingredient you won't find in any other bar. Mosh is now the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizin, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. But here's the best part to make you feel good. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Why gender-based? Because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. These bars are delicious, and they give so many choices that you'll be sure to find something that will just be perfect for you. I love the blueberry almond bars, and I also love the fact that none of them has more than 3 grams of sugar. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/Mona to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack at moshlife, that's moshlife.com/Mona. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode.
So a through line in your fiction writing does involve repressive regimes and people being forced to live under them. So I want to ask you whether there was any thought as you were composing this book about, political issues or the dangers of totalitarianism of whatever stripe.
Absolutely. And again, this has been a part of the through line of my history, my personal and political history. I was first attracted to Ronald Reagan because, of his strong stand against the Soviet Union and the idea of repression and the totalitarian control. And the thing about the Inquisition was that in order to find these secret Jews, they relied on people who were basically, ratting out their neighbors. And of course, as in any repressive system, some people rat out their neighbors because they had a fight over, the fence line or something. It has nothing to do with anything ideological or religious. Yeah, most of it. Right. And so living in a society where you can't trust people and where you have to constantly be on guard, this is something that has obsessed me forever, because most of the short stories that I published were about North Korean prison camps.
Right.
Also, I don't know what it is in my history or my psyche that I'm very obsessed with this idea of torture. It plays a role here.
Torture is the one thing I can tolerate. Violence in movies and television programs, I can tolerate vulgarity, although I don't like it. But the one thing I cannot watch is torture scenes if they're depicted on screen.
There's not a whole lot of that in my novel, by the way.
No, there isn't.
But it's
implied.
Sort of offstage. Yeah, but it's part of the plot. It's always in people's minds.
It's always, yes. And people will do anything under torture. I mean, anything.
That's right. You will denounce. Right. And in fact, one of the characters in the novel is a woman who gives up her daughter, denounces her daughter. So it's, this is clearly something. And of course, this sort of brings us to the present time. And what is it about anti-Semitism? Why are Jews so persecuted?
Yeah. But before we get there, though, I want to just do a little detour into one other aspect of your story, because I did not realize until I read this novel that there were slaves in Spain.
Yes.
You think of, that the Spanish conquistadors, that there was slavery in the New World under Spanish authority, but not, I didn't picture it in Spain itself. So one of your main characters in the novel is a slave. So tell us about that.
And in some sense, I think she's the heart of the novel, Esperanza. I took the name from the records because when my family departed Spain, listed on the manifest were not just the husband and wife, their children, but also their slaves that they brought to the New World. Then sort of doing some digging into history. So these were mostly household workers. They were people who lived, within the household. Sometimes they were given their freedom at some point, during the period, but not always. So they could be passed down as property. And in fact, in my family wills, they are passed down as property. Mm. So that was another really big eye opener for my family owned slaves, really. And in slaves, in Spain.
Esperanza in your novel is African.
Yes, she's taken from Africa. Right.
But a lot of the slaves, I gather, were not African. Mm-hmm. Some of them were former Berbers or,
Right.
They are technically, but they're Arab.
Right.
And there were, tell us about that. Was it a racial thing or mostly a conquered people's thing?
It was mostly a conquered people thing, but interestingly, there are very famous stories in the New World when Spain tried to enslave, the Indians, they mm-hmm. found. The church actually stepped in. There were actually critics of this. They were forced to convert to Catholicism, the Indians, the indigenous people, in the New World. But they were not supposed to be enslaved. They were like indentured servants more than slaves. But people don't realize this. Mexico actually imported from Africa as many slaves, Black African slaves, as Spaniards. So when you look at, you know, the Mexicans are called mestizos. They are mixed race people. And in fact, in sort of the Spanish tradition of, there's actually a very famous mural in a museum in Denver, which depicts every possible combination of racial mixture, you know, and they had names for it all. So, you know, Spaniards who married Spaniards but were born in the New World had one designation. Spaniards who married Indians had another. Indians who married Blacks had another. You know, Spaniards who had, you know, married Blacks. So they're all of these very names. They could have taught the South Africans a thing or two about racial, and probably did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Esperanza, she's the heart of the novel. She's the most admirable. You get really annoyed with Guiomar. Sort of like, yeah, she's so annoying. my wonderful editor, Adam Bellow of Wicked Sun, who published the book, you know, he said, why did you make her? You know, what was the thought behind this? Well, I don't know. That's just the way. If you're a writer of fiction, you don't have so much control. You're sitting there at the computer and you're writing, and these characters become real.
That's so amazing.
You know, and so, you know, you're in her head and you're seeing the world through her eyes. And this is who she was. She was just annoying. I'm sorry.
Well, she does mature.
She matures, right. Yeah. She was a very young woman. It takes place over 10 years. She gets married. She has children. She has to face the Inquisition and the Grand Inquisitor of Sevilla.
Exactly. And she shows real courage, and I admire her for that. But honestly, her treatment of her children, especially the little girl, I was ready to slap her.
I know. And interestingly, again, from the description on the manifest when they left Spain, it describes the little girl as having this birthmark on her face.
Yeah.
And so
that's why Guiomar at first rejects her daughter.
She rejects it because she's not beautiful.
She's not beautiful.
And she and Guiomar herself is quite beautiful. So it's and she's been forced to marry this guy she had no interest in and didn't, you know, it's beneath her, etc. And then she has this child that, you know, is not gorgeous. And so she eventually warms up.
She does eventually, thank goodness. But you also drop a hint in the novel, like when they're escaping to the New World, this family, that Guiomar thinks that this is their deliverance. But then you point out that in Mexico, there was an Inquisition.
The Inquisition lasted almost 400 years. It started before the Jews were kicked out of Spain. I think it was 1478 was the first. And it went into the 19th century until about 1834, something like that, in the New World. There were burnings. There were auto de fes in Mexico City, also in Peru and elsewhere. So they followed them. So I hope to write a sequel.
Yeah.
So you'll find out more about what happens to them when they get to the New World. So, you know, there's that.
Cool. All right. So let me ask you this. You chose to write a novel about one of the darkest chapters in church history.
Mm-hmm.
And the church comes off, you know, you're pretty tough on them. I mean, you know, there's a lot of horror there. The chief inquisitor that you profile is a masochist as well as being a sadist. And punishes his own body and, you know, various ways.
Self-flagellation.
And you give one detail that really stuck with me where he keeps rice in his little chamber so that he can put it on the floor and kneel on it while he's flagellating.
To cause extra pain. That, by the way, is something I knew about from New Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. I mean, that tradition was carried into New Mexico.
Yeah. There are a number of traditions, religious traditions that involve self-harm. I think the Shiites have a yearly procession where the men flagellate themselves. I'm not sure if it's Shiites or Sunnis, but anyway, it's a Muslim practice too. But anyway, you've chosen to focus on a very dark chapter in church history. And I wonder how you feel about that. I mean, do you now identify as a Catholic? Do you still like practice the religion or do you not? And if you do, how do you feel? How does this all this?
Yeah. So it is all very complicated. Theologically, I find Judaism more satisfying, you know, one God, not a Trinity, because that is one of the things about Christianity that to me, and even again, as a child, how can it be three persons in one? Who is this Holy Ghost guy? You know, why would God send his child down to the world to, you know, to end up crucified and, you know, take the burden of our sins? So I find the monotheism of Judaism, more appealing. But my husband, even though he was raised Jewish, his father actually thought about becoming a rabbi and ended up becoming a doctor. But they belonged to a synagogue and they certainly wanted their son married in a synagogue. So we never joined a synagogue. So I don't have that connection. And I still have very strong emotional attachment and cultural attachment to Catholicism. So you can probably tell I've got very fine detail in there about Catholic ritual and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's a hard issue to really identify. My boys were all bar mitzvahed, but then my oldest son ended up converting to Catholicism. So conversions have became in my family.
And the tradition continues.
And the tradition continues. I'm very deeply, I think I used to say this on Beg to Differ, I consider myself a Zionist. I very much, believe in the state of Israel. And so it's complicated.
You have a dual identity.
I have a dual identity. What can I say?
Let us now turn, if you don't mind, to a few things from the current situation. I've missed our talks about immigration and about current political stories. Right after the election, you and I were at a meeting and we were discussing what we anticipated that Trump 2.0 would be like. I feel comfortable saying that we didn't even quite grasp how bad it was.
Absolutely. I think that's right. I did say the mass raids were coming and they were going to be, snatching people, but I had no idea they were jumping out of unmarked cars in masks and with weapons and snatching people off the street. This is not Pinochet's Chile. You know, this is the United States of America.
And snatching them off the street to send them to a foreign country's gulag.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, El Salvador, Marco Rubio, a man I used to deeply respect, a man whose name I wrote in 2016, rather than vote for either the Democrat or Donald Trump, the Republican. He's busy negotiating with states like Libya, Sudan, to take American people who've been,
living
deported
here,
deported from the United States, and send them there. And by the way, it's like sending them to the Castillo San Jorge. I mean, these are dungeons. These are places where people are tortured,
they have no legal recourse. There's no way.
Well, once they're out of the country, that's what the administration is asserting. I would assert that that's not true, that they are entitled to due process.
I meant the dungeons where they are sending them or planning to send them. These are countries where you cannot appeal. You cannot get, legal process. I mean, that's it.
Nothing. There's nothing. Right. And by the way, they're not sending people from those countries back. It's not like they're sending Salvadorans to El Salvador and Libyans to Libya and Sudanese. They're sending, people from Venezuela because Venezuela won't take back the people who are here in the United States. They're sending, people from Asia It's really quite horrifying. And it
is the thing about the Venezuelans. I mean, let's pause on that for just a sec, because, you know, one of the things, one of the reasons that larger numbers of Hispanics have been moving toward the Republican Party in the United States is because so many immigrants have come from left-wing countries mm-hmm. that have been so oppressive, including Venezuela, mm-hmm. right? So they come here, and then these Venezuelans, I got to imagine 99% of whom, maybe 99.5% of whom are just looking for a better life, just looking to escape, right? I mean, and they, and some of them who are citizens have voted for Trump, because he's not going to be like those Venezuelans, right. Like the left-wing Venezuelan
guys. Adios, right.
Trump removes their
temporary protected status and parole. Yep.
Yeah, and parole. Okay, explain that.
The Biden administration can be criticized for the way in which they let the border get totally out of control. We used to talk about it a lot on Big
Of
today.
Course. Yeah.
And I think when Americans heard Trump, what they wanted was the border controlled, and then they wanted criminals who were here or gang members who were here to be deported.
Yeah.
They didn't want their neighbor from their evangelical church, you know, who prays with him every Wednesday and Sunday or whatever. They didn't want that person who's been living here, by the way, 20 years and whose kids are American citizens by birth, although Trump's trying to change that too. But what Biden did during his tenure, and I actually did support it, was he created a more orderly process. He put together an app that people who were coming from, you know, crossing the Darien Straits and, you know, at great peril coming towards the United States before they got here, they could apply for asylum. Now, if you were coming from Venezuela, as many of these people were, and you were being persecuted in Venezuela for your political beliefs because you mm-hmm. were against the Chavez first and then the Maduro government. That's what our asylum laws were created for.
Yeah.
What most people don't know is that you can't claim asylum until you step foot on American soil. So they would, apply to come in, to meet at the border, to be entered into the United States, and then they would file for asylum. Now, what Biden did towards the end of his administration was he created a special category of people from Haiti, from Cuba, from Venezuela, and from Nicaragua. Now, certainly Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba are all, you know, left-wing pro-communist kind of dictatorships, very much in the tradition of the kind of people that we give asylum to. Haiti is more an anarchical situation, but they can't go home. I mean, they're in great risk. And to me, that made sense, you know, give these people a chance. They were given temporary status, wouldn't last forever, but at least it would be orderly. There weren't people rushing through the border. They were coming, they were meeting, you know, border patrol at the ports of entry and then being allowed. They could be vetted, right? And they have to, you know, they produce their, you know, their papers such as they have from their home country. And the vast majority of these people, they just want a better life for themselves and for their children. And they also take jobs in America that most Americans shun. Most Americans don't want to work in a meat processing plant. And I know this because I used to be on the board of directors of one of the biggest, you know, chicken companies in the country. And to find people born in the United States who are willing to do that is very, very difficult. And so giving them the ability to work and to take jobs that we need doing in our society, but Americans may not want to take, and for good reason, Americans are too well educated. But these are the sort of stepping stones for these newcomers, and they will provide a way to move in and eventually to become assimilated, move up the economic ladder. But now, you know, he's withdrawn that. He's withdrawn that status. And by the way, it's not just for Venezuelans, for Afghans, people who fled Afghanistan, people who were interpreters, people who worked on our bases and have been given, you know, a status here in the United States. They're being denied. Ukrainians whose country is at war, they're being having their status revoked.
It is so indecent and cruel. I mean, they don't for one second put themselves in the, you know, heart and mind of somebody like a Venezuelan or an Afghan who has fled persecution and say, well, my God, what do you expect? I mean, it's one thing to say you're not going to offer it at all, which is not nice, but that's quite different from then pulling the rug out from somebody
who's here,
already here and has already been offered this thing. I mean, it is just so despicable. I agree that that Americans were okay with deportations of what they perceived to be criminals. But you notice now, of course, and this was inevitable, they're moving the goalposts. They couldn't find enough immigrants.
Of course not, right?
It would actually
require some competence.
Yeah.
You know, in the early days, I sit on the board of a nonprofit that does work in the immigration area. And one of the people who serves on the board used to work in ICE, used to be in ICE. And, you know, he said it really wouldn't be that difficult to get a list of the people who had served time in prison and to go through, but it would require, you know, some systematic work. You'd actually have to do it systematically and competently. No, they're just going into Latino neighborhoods. And by the way,
exactly,
a lot of the people they're grabbing. Yeah. Or Home Depot. Yeah. And, you know, it is horrifying.
And when people object, wait, you said you were only going to go after criminals. Their reply is, well, they're here illegally, so they committed a crime.
Right. But they didn't really. It's a civil.
Exactly.
It's a civil offense. It's like, you know, you can usually just pay a fine. And for the most part, unless they've come multiple times or unless they've been evicted and then come back, it's not usually treated as a criminal offense. It can be, but usually it's considered just a civil offense. So, and, you know, they're taking children. In Los Angeles, you had ICE, somebody from DHS, it may not have been ICE, but coming into grade schools and, you know, looking at children. And I think, you know, you need to remind people that, you know, there are 11 million or so, probably higher than that. It's probably now 12 or 13 million people who are here illegally. About a third of them are people who have overstayed their visa. So they may have come here as students or whatever, or had a work permit and then just overstayed their visa, or tourists. Yeah. Although if you're coming from Latin America, it's really hard to get a tourist visa, because they're, you know, they want to make sure you have ties in your home country. They we're sort of caught on to that. But the point is, they're not realizing, a lot of Americans don't realize most of these people, half of these people, have been here more than a decade. They set down roots. They pay taxes. I happen to know somebody in my own community. He is a very successful contractor. He came here at 16 years of age, not legally. He probably has 20 people working for him. He pays taxes, big, big checks to the IRS because he is successful. He's bonded. He's licensed. He has terrific reputation. He has to worry, and his workers have to worry. I mean, I talked to him recently. He said, my guys won't go to Home Depot to pick up, you know, the lumber or whatever he needs on the site. They're afraid. So I have to go. And I said, well, you know, you're not any safer because of, and he said, yeah, but I thought they were only going after criminals. I've never even gotten a speeding ticket. If they find him, they could deport him.
And so it remains to be seen whether there will be any kind of a political backlash to this, because as we know, the only institution in American society, pretty much, well, I would say there are two institutions that are still holding their own, the courts and the press. Although the press is wobbly.
They're you know, hedging their bets. I mean, Terry Moran lost his job.
Yeah, so. Exactly. No, that's absolutely right. And 60 Minutes, you know.
60 is Minutes is caving, and, right, yeah.
So they're wobbly, the main way, I think you'd agree, that this movement toward authoritarianism in our country can be thwarted as if there's a political backlash. And there are some polls that suggest that at least among Hispanic Americans who voted for Trump, there has been a strong reaction. I don't know.
Absolutely. And of course, these are citizens who are voting. It isn't, none of these recent people came across are in fact voting. It is only US or people like me whose family have been here literally hundreds of years.
Right.
But, you know, my very first book, Out of the Barrio, was called Out of the Barrio, Toward a New Politics of Hispanic Assimilation. And it was written in 1991. And I was talking about the Hispanic community, which at the time, many people would thought was going to be a permanent underclass, you know, and when you looked at the statistics, well, they didn't graduate high school, blah, 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 you know, they're poor, weren't usually on welfare, but they were poor. And so they're going to stay that way forever. And I said, well, you know, you have to dig a little deeper. And I actually disaggregated the numbers. And I looked at people, you know, who had been here, born here, learned English. And even if you weren't born here, English was the single biggest factor. If you were fluent in English, the likelihood is you earned the same thing as a non-Hispanic did, as actually not just non-Hispanic, as whites did, with comparable experience and education. At the time in 1991, Hispanics were not going to college and they graduated high school, but they weren't necessarily going to college. That has changed. Hispanics are now, in fact, going to college, graduating college. So the point is, these are people who, like Jews, Italians, Greeks, Poles, Russians, etc., who came at the beginning of the 20th century. Sure, they're on the bottom rungs of the ladder when they get here, when they got off the boat. They're not doctors and lawyers then, but their kids or grandkids become doctors and lawyers, and they move up the ladder. And that's what these immigrants are coming here. I mean, the people who believe most in America, who think America is great, who are they? There are people who are traversing the Darien Gap, which is one of the most dangerous, you know, physically challenging places to come, and trekking thousands of miles to get to the United States. These are people who believe in America. And immigrants are self-selected. It isn't everybody in a society, even a very poor society, who will come here. It's hard to come to America.
You have to
learn a new language. You have to learn a new culture. Everything is different. And so immigrants are self-selected for people who have that kind of drive. And they do just fine when they get here. The immigrant generation may not become, particularly the women, may not become fluent in English, but their kids are. Their kids do. And they move into the middle class and they become, you know, undifferentiated from everybody else.
And yet, despite this tremendous record of success of assimilating all kinds of people from every culture and continent around the globe to the United States, arguably we are there are other countries that are good at assimilation, but we're the best. I mean,
Israel and the U.S., I think, are the two best at assimilating people.
And yet we have, with the arrival of MAGA, we're transforming what has been a great strength of ours into a weakness. And we're playing upon ancient fears of the other and trying to portray immigrants as predators, as criminals, as invaders. People are not coming anymore, Linda. That he's solved that problem.
Yeah,
nobody wants
right,
to come.
No, right.
Why would they?
Including people that he might even approve of who are from Northern Europe.
Exactly. Know. Nobody's going to come now. And plus, you know, this may be the first year. It was a story in the paper where more people will leave the United States than will come.
Last time that happened was during the Depression, I believe. The Great Depression in the 1930s.
Congratulations, to the MAGA forces. You've made this such an unwelcoming and bad place that people are actually, more people want to leave than want to come. We're also looking at destroying the things that make the United States special, like our universities, learning, science, progress, innovation. Immigrants are a huge source of innovation.
Absolutely.
You know, and anyway, so all of that, it's amazing, isn't it, that so much has been destroyed in such a short period of time. Such,
right. It is rather unbelievable. And by the way, it's going to take a long time to recover. I mean, the whole, what we're doing in health, what RFK is accomplishing in health, he's going to bring back diseases that were wiped out in my lifetime. Yep. I mean, smallpox may be back at some point. Certainly polio is going to be, which was something, you know, I was a young child when polio ravaged America. I have friends. I have a very close friend of mine who has post-polio syndrome because, you know, she got polio before there were shots available.
Yeah.
This is going to happen. But it's also one
by
of the
way, did you get checked? I did. I had my, when I had my annual physical this year, when we were doing blood work, I asked them to do a titer for measles because I wondered, am I
very
still
good?
Immune? You know, yep. I don't know. I don't remember. I think I had it, but I don't know. And
that's a very and did you find out that you did have it?
I did have it. Yeah. So yeah. I'm not. So
that's
I'm
a very good. I haven't made my annual physical. I'm going to put that on the list of things that I want to check
list,
for.
Because yeah, you don't know. You probably don't remember whether you had measles as a child or not.
I don't. I know I had chicken pox. And of course, I got shingles when I, you know, when in my 50s because I had chicken pox.
Yeah,
so, yeah. And so this is going to be very hard to come, you know, to overcome. And by the way, even the question of removing, you know, if Trump were successful and he could remove, you know, 10 million people, however many he keeps throwing out the figure 20 million. That's just ridiculous. That had to do with the number of people encountered at the border. Most of them were immediately sent back. You know, we don't have 31 million people living in the country illegally. I'm sorry, it just isn't true. But if we were able to do that, the economy would collapse. I mean, you're talking about the illegal immigrants in the workforce are about 5% of the workforce. You cannot remove 5% of the labor force and not have it affect everybody else.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's even now some of the downturn in consumer spending, who's not spending money? People who are undocumented. They don't want to go to the store. They are not, you know, Coca-Cola announced their profits are down 3%. Apparently, Coca-Cola is very popular in the Hispanic community, and they drink what's called Mexican Coke. It's actually a different formula than the Coke in the United States. I'm in New Mexico right now, and you can buy Mexican Coke here in New Mexico. But their profits are down.
Yeah.
The restaurants that, and not just Mexican restaurants, but chains are experiencing fewer people. Number one, they don't have people to work in them, so that's hurting them. But also the customers, you know, people who are undocumented rent houses, buy cars, spend their money, you know, at the grocery store and in department stores, and they're scared to go out now. So they're not spending money. So this is going to affect all of us. And oh, by the way, those of us old enough, I'm not sure you're yet old enough, but, you know, who collect Social Security checks, who do you think is paying a lot of the Social Security? You know, people who are not here legally, but who do in fact have Social Security numbers, and their money goes into the Social Security fund and to the Medicare fund, and then they'll never be able to draw on it.
That's it. That's the irony. You know,
right.
It's like you talk to the average Trump voter, and they think, oh, those immigrants, you know, they're getting all these benefits, and they weren't even born here, and it's not fair. The truth, I'm sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen, is many of these illegal immigrants are paying into the system and will never get an opportunity to receive those benefits themselves.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And in fact, the Social Security Administration has actually put out numbers in previous administrations about how big a portion of the Social Security fund and the Medicare fund in particular are being paid for by people who are undocumented.
Do you happen to remember what that was?
Gosh, it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. I've actually written on. I think if you Google Linda Chavez and, you know, Medicare and Social Security, you'll come up with the number.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up. That's a useful.
It's, and I think Cato Institution did studies on it. There are various groups that have done studies on that because, you know, again, most people think, well, Social Security, the money I get, that's money I put in. No, not really. It's money paid for by workers today.
No. And the fact is, most people who receive Social Security benefits get more back than they
put in. Yeah. Yes. Even high income people. Yeah.
Even high income people.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's true.
And Oh, boy. Okay, Linda, still lots of work to do to try to combat the disinformation and lies out there. It
absolutely is. I will point people to my website about my book.
Please.
It is www.lindachavezauthor.com. And you can go and read all about the book. There's a link where you can order the book. It came out last week, June 17th. And it's available. It is only in paperback and on Kindle. And I urge people to go and read it.
Me too. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a great pleasure to reconnect.